Nunatak, Temple of Ice, CDSK, and Flip, Switch, and Roll. This is Staying In.
Welcome back, Peter.
Hello.
You're alive.
Yes, it's me.
His voice has returned.
Everything's returned. It's all come back.
Thank goodness, honestly, at this point. God, I felt awful. This cold that's going around.
What you had was not a cold. You messaged us saying, lads, for the first time in a week, I've got out of bed and had a shower. That is not,
that's
a
not
cold.
A cold is 2 to 3 days max.
And you can get out of bed and function like a normal being.
Yeah.
If you have to burn where you were sleeping.
And yeah. I did. So yeah, it wasn't great. I've basically been ill for like 2.5 weeks, and yeah, I did lose my voice. I lost my voice entirely. That was good.
What did you miss most about your voice? I mean, the listeners missed out.
Massively.
Oh, well, yeah, indubitably. I think the thing that I missed out most on, it's going to sound very soppy, is that Alex would say, do you want this thing? And I would go, and I would just have to nod. Yeah, and I would just like nod. And then I'd usually like try and make conversation, right? I'd usually say, how's your day gone? Or like, oh, thanks so much, I really like this, or whatever it was. And instead I'd just have to go, mm-hmm. And it was deeply, deeply infuriating.
I thought you were going to say you were going to be like Andrew Lincoln in Love Actually.
Yes. Oh, he doesn't get that reference.
No. I had a geography teacher who...
What? Where is this going?
Yeah.
At school, who'd lost their voice, but rather than taking a day off sick, she gave the class, but the school gave her a whistle.
Okay.
To teach geography.
Right.
It was chaos. It was absolute chaos.
Was it at least a slide whistle so she could have done topography?
Not at all. No, Sam. Like a classic referee's whistle with like the little pin in it.
What kind of like geographic lesson plans do you think could be accomplished with just a whistle? Like outside of like teaching the continents, like you could point at Europe and blow a whistle.
The best thing you can do is you can go and get the television that's trapped inside that frame on wheels that every school has.
Like Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah, and then wheel it into the classroom, put in a VHS, and treat it as if this is some sort of special occasion and not even really make reference to the fact that you've lost your voice, just to demonstrate a level of control.
Okay, here you go. Here's a scenario. Pete, you're going to be rubbish at this, but I'm hoping Dan and Chris will fill the void. You're teaching a geography lesson.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You've lost your voice. Mm. You've got access somehow to a whole load of DVDs, and you've got to pick one film that's geography-based, and you can probably get away with it, but it's slightly educational.
I mean, I'm assuming we're not going to just have like My Planet type thing.
No. It's got to be a fictional movie.
A movie, okay. Yeah.
I've got an example, Sam. This actually came up. My geology teacher, Doc Rock, which is what we called him, he showed us the classic film, The Core.
Okay. Isn't that when they... No. What's the one where they tried to drill to the other side of the Earth? Is that The Core?
Yeah, they go to the centre, basically, to kickstart the planet. And he used it as an educational exercise to prove how it was wrong. So he talked throughout.
Oh, right. Well, that's a nuisance.
Explaining why it was wrong.
So I would have gone with something kind of a bit simpler in terms of like an Indiana Jones, which is both globetrotting and has a map.
I was thinking Dante's Peak, but you know.
That is a good film. That is a classic film of that era of the early kind of late 90s, early 2000s kind of disaster movie, but in a Western populous area like Volcano, for example.
And you'd always get two movies for one. So you got Dante's Peak, Volcano. You got Armageddon and...
Deep Impact,
yeah.
You had the one that was like a flood... in a subway or something like that.
With Sylvester Stallone.
Yeah.
Oh, Daylight.
Yes.
And then there was Heavy Rain.
Hard Rain.
With Hard Rain, that's it.
not the Quantum Dream murder mystery.
But I think instead of giving Miss Hilling a whistle, they should have just given her a drum pad.
Or, I don't know, like a notepad and paper and pen, like something that can easily communicate.
Or the day off.
All the day off. No. Yes. That is the real elephant in the room here.
Luckily, though, Pete, you recovered just in time to make the short 5-hour journey.
Oh, God.
From where you live.
Yeah.
To aircon.
Yes.
But that's where we were.
It's where we were, 5 hours away from Bristol. So that's in Harrogate. They're doing a second one soon, aren't they? They're doing 2 a year at some point soon.
So now since last year, I think, there is now Aircon Northwest as well as Aircon Prime. And so Aircon Northwest is in Manchester, in the exhibition space there, which used to be a train station, I think.
Cool.
Or something like that.
Cool.
And I haven't been to that one yet, but I'm going to try and go this year, I think. I think it was in December last year, but they may have moved it up until the summer.
Interesting.
Which makes sense.
The three of us, sans Dan, all met up for a weekend of board game fun. And it was lovely. It continues to be my favourite atmosphere of any of the conventions. As we talked about before, it's not as retail-y as UK Games Expo, which, if that's what you're after, like, UKGE just blows out of the water. But like, in terms of playing, sitting and playing, like, Aircon's way better. Like, way, way, way better.
Yeah.
In terms of like facilities and stuff like that, and that sounds like such an old person thing to say, but like, there's lots of really nice places to eat in Harrogate that are really close by. Whereas you go to UKGE and like, you're lucky to get a Subway.
So when you said the facilities, I immediately thought, oh, some nice toilets there, are there?
That is important. And to be honest, in Aircon's defense, like, they are centrally based.
Yep.
So the two halls are divided by the toilet blocks. So
It's prime location. And honestly, I would say that I've had less nasty incidents in the aircon bathrooms than I have at many a video game convention or even UKGE, I would say.
Well, I don't know how much that's got to do with the toilet as it is your bowels.
Well, no. I don't mean... Well, okay, I shouldn't say me having those incidents, but me perhaps bearing witness to the after effects of those incidents. So they're routinely cleaned. And, you know, the other good things as well, like the hall remains open until, you know, 10, 11 o'clock at night, which means that you can stay and play games in the evening. Oh, no.
Yeah, it stays open till 1:30 in the morning.
Wow. Okay. Yep. There you go. So the reason I must have thought it was 10 or 11 o'clock is because that's when my bedtime is and I like to go home by that point.
Puts his little hat on.
Yep. So, and that's really good because basically it means that, you know, they keep open a little tuck shop and they have a little beer shop as well where you can go and get drinks and, you know, bits and pieces. And it means you can just stay in playing games with pals, with strangers, playing new games, playing old games. It's great. Like, it's really, really wonderful.
I thought that this year felt different to me from last year.
Yep.
And I think that I just didn't want to spend as much time in the hall and in the retail space. I mean, we did, and I'm only referring it to the retail space for kind of a bit of ease of translation of what that means. But obviously, it's full of like loads of like indie games and indie independent publishers and companies who are all doing something board game adjacent. Of course, we spent time in there. And we spoke to lots of lovely people, of which we'll name a few in a bit. But I felt the more of the urge this year to actually sit down and play.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether it's just because we didn't do that so much last year, but this year it really felt like they put those players first and they really care about meeting the needs of those people who are playing games. So last year I didn't really notice this. So whether it's a new thing or whether it just passed us by, but you're right, as we were playing, someone came around with a little mobile tuck shop, mm-hmm. which was selling crisps and chocolates and some beers and some drinks. And as we were playing on one night, a nice gentleman came up to us and told us very, very politely that the bar is going to be closing soon if we'd like another drink, and now is the time to go and get some. And I thought that was, you know, things like that are really easy and really simple. So therefore, they're always often the things that get overlooked or not done.
Yep.
But they're the things that made me feel really welcome in the space, yep. and welcome to play games. And it wasn't like I was there as a nuisance and there was someone just looking at their watch going, I can't wait until these bozos are out so I can get in here and clean.
Let's not muck around. Like, so much of modern society now is how can we extract money from you as quickly as possible? And you sitting there and, you know, you could have bought your own drinks and snacks and all that sort of stuff. You sitting there and playing games is not earning necessarily the money for the convention center, right? But they just go, yeah, here we go. This is a space for you. I think there are a couple of other reasons that I think we spent less time in the retail space. It wasn't quite as there weren't as many big names there this year. So for example, I think Zatu had a stand last year, and I think Cosmos had a stand last year, and I think there were a couple of other stands last year that were a little bigger. And though they didn't seem to have those this year, there were a couple of big companies. Let's not muck around. There still were a couple of bigger companies. So, for example, they were showing off a bunch of Star Wars games. Ravensburger was there with Lorcana.
Hachette.
Hachette was there as well. So there were definitely stands and there was definitely big stuff. I would say there was a bit more of a focus on more independent stuff, which I think is absolutely fine. And I'm really interested to see what happens next year. Like, I really want to know what happens. Like, do they get bigger stands in again? Do they double down on the indie stuff? Do they, how do they treat? Do they expand the retail space out a little bit? Like, that'd be really interesting to see as well. So,
because how it's grown since we started going to now is a really interesting thing to track. And I think it's one of those things, like, we got speaking to someone who was quite in on basically how Aircon is kind of tracking in terms of its popularity. And they were saying that it's tracking the same as like UK Games Expo was/is, which is really interesting. But I think that some of that is really trying to find out what works and what is actually beneficial for the people who are attending and what people get out of it. And I think ultimately you can have the big companies there like Zatu, and you can have people like there like Cosmos. And I think actually what Cosmos did this year was probably quite typical of what something like Aircon will eventually be, where Cosmos didn't have a stand. And that's because they just had a big bag of their games and they're just wandering around the playing floor with one of the big lightsabers that said, come and play with us.
Yep.
And they were just playing with people. And it felt like that focus was really the important thing. And
agreed.
All of the bigger stands like Hachette and Coiled Spring and Ravensburger with Lorcana and all the Star Wars stuff, there was no one really there standing by a load of games talking about it. They were all tables, all chairs, always getting people to come and play something and engage with the games. Like, that seems to be the big driver of Aircon, is like, here's a table, here's a seat, come and sit and play, rather than let's talk.
Mm-hmm.
Which probably leads me to the one of the standout games that I played at Aircon. Let's not beat around the bush. I think this is certainly one of my highlights. So much so that I managed to blag us a copy for the podcast nice. For us to review.
Nice.
And I've been playing it pretty much not every day since I came back, but quite a lot, because as you'll see, it's just one of these games that I love to keep around and really like pester my wife by asking her trivia and getting her to ask me trivia, okay. as well as playing it with my family.
Sam, I'm sleeping. Oh. Just one more.
The minute me and Chris walked on the show floor, we got shown to this game called CDSK. Here it is. Here's the box for everyone on camera.
Wow.
And I'm now going to set up the game.
He has opened the box.
There you go. I've set up the game.
Wow.
That's it. I have set up the game. So how CDSK works, and we're going to play a little bit, the three of you, is there's four categories of questions, basically. CDSK, there's curious, delightful, seasoned, and knowledge.
Okay.
And the inside the gaming lid, which is where you play the game, is like a little track, like a little like racetrack that you go around. And it's the first player basically to get to the end, they win.
Cool.
How you move up the track is by answering questions. And this is the brilliant twist, and this is where I feel like they've stumbled across something which is so simple in its design that I'm kind of nervy about saying that they've like revolutionized trivia games, because it seems like, why has no one thought of this before?
Mm.
And it just seems like a way of tackling trivia, and specifically family trivia games, that is just it just really makes it so much more simpler and engaging.
Can I just ask, before we kind of get into kind of the bones of this, like,
mm-hmm.
and this may be part of the bones that you're going to discuss, but the always the issue I have with trivia games is a lot of the time they make me feel stupid for not knowing kind of the answers. That's why I love certain games where they're not necessarily trivia games, but something like a Boulder Dash, something like that, where the idea is that you don't know the answer. No one's going to know the answer. So you make up ones that are going to sound right. But there is obviously an answer there. So, like, yeah. Does this suffer from the element of, like, are there hard questions that kind of are going to make me like, oh, I'm not very smart?
There are hard questions that will make you feel that you're not very smart. But that is all of your own making, as I will now reveal. So,
okay, here we go.
Usually in the game, there's about like 30 or 40 or so spaces. But we're just going to play to the first to get to 10 points, okay? All you got to do is get to 10 points.
Mm-hmm.
Bring it on.
So, because Dan wasn't at Aircon, Dan's going to go first. And you'll start with a C question, which is curious. So, Dan, on a scale of 1 to 10... how well do you know mythical creatures?
Oh.
Now, this is how the game works. So I've got 10 questions on this card. The number one question, super duper easy. The number 10 question, incredibly difficult. But if you get the 10 question right, you move up 10 spaces on the board. But if you just get a question one right, you just move up one space.
I don't know them very well.
So from the scale of 1 to 10... how well do you know mythical creatures? So you could just play it safe, go for a 1 or a 2, maybe gamble on a 4 or a 5, maybe.
I'm going to gamble, and I think this is showing... this is a gamble for me, and I think I'm going to kind of be hoisted by my own petard. But I'm going to go with 4, and that's me gambling.
Okay. Okay, here we go. Number 4.
Yeah.
To go 4 spaces up the board.
Gotcha.
Is a beast that is half man and half bull called a centaur, a hardcore, a Minotaur, or a Benicio del Toro?
That's a Minotaur.
It is a Minotaur. 4 points for you, Dan. Well done.
Yes!
So you go 4 up the track. Right, so now we go to Chris, who also gets a C card. So on a scale of 1 to 10, how well do you know emblematic animals?
Emblematic animals... let's go with a 5.
Name the animal emblem of Russia.
It's a bear.
Any particular type of bear?
A Russian bear.
Russian bear? Winnie the Pooh. it's a bear.
It's a brown bear. Sorry, Chris.
What?
Okay, you can... Right, so that means Chris goes boop, 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 boop. 5 points to Dan's four. Right, Peter, from a scale of... On a scale of 1 to 10, how well do you know yawning?
Three?
Okay, on average, how many times a day does a person yawn? 1 to 4, 5 to 10, or 11 to 15?
5 to 10?
Correct, you got 3 points. So wow. Peter's there on 3, Dan's on 4, and Chris is on 5.
Ah, this is very clever.
So now, Dan, you're on an S space. So you get this card. So on a scale of 1 to 10, Dan, how well do you know cocktails?
Ooh, I have been looking at cocktails recently.
So S is seasoned, which means grown-up stuff, school of life, you know, yeah, proper trivial pursuit.
I mean, I might take a risk on this. And I might go for
go on then.
And I might go for a 6.
You're going to go for a 6, so you're going to go for the win.
Godspeed, okay. Daniel.
Okay. What is the name of the cocktail inspired by a caipirinha, where the cachaça is replaced with vodka?
Is it a mojito?
No, it's a caipirosca.
I went for it.
You went for it. So Dan's still there on 4 points. Chris, you went 5 points. That means you get another curious, very precise or bizarre subjects. So on a scale of 1 to 10, Chris, how well do you know Big Ben? And by that I mean...
The building.
It's not Sam's mate down the pub.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, no. Well, Big Ben is the name of the bell. Yeah, we all know that. Yeah. It's not a mate.
Yeah, thanks for clearing that up. I will go with a 2.
A 2. Is Big Ben located in Paris, Moscow or London?
Oh my God.
Right, I really undersold that, didn't I? I would go with a... I'll go with London, please.
Okay, correct. 2 points. You're up to 7 now. Playing it safe. Very good.
That's what they say about me.
So, Pete, you're still on 3 points, which means you get a knowledge card. Science, nature, history or geography. On a scale of 1 to 10, Pete, how well do you know famous explorers?
Maybe a 4.
In what year did Captain Cook become the first European to discover Australia? Give or take 30 years.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Australia. All right. When did we... Okay. 1770.
That is absolutely 100% the exact year.
Is it?
Oh, can he get an extra point for that, Sam?
Yeah, of course he can, yeah. So we'll get 5 points for that. Oh. Well done. So that means you're on 8 points now.
Okay.
I'm very impressed, Gungadin.
Thank you.
Daniel's still on 4, so I'll go to you next. You're on an S question. Dan, on a scale of 1 to 10, how well do you know UK currency? Are you going to go for the win?
Oh, of course, 6.
Okay. When placed in the correct arrangement, what do the 1p, 2p, 5p, 10p, 20p and 50p coins depict?
The coat of arms.
Of?
The royal family?
The shield of the royal coat of arms.
Wow.
Whoa.
So Dan, there you go. You win. There are additional rules if you actually do get to the end. You've got to answer one final question to claim the win, but I feel like we've had enough fun with CDSK for now.
And I won, so let's just leave it there.
And you won. But me and Chris were just like, oh, we'll go and see what this game's all about, and ended up playing an entire game between the two of us. At which point, like, you know, usually at conventions you get someone who starts like showing you the game, explaining the game. Like I don't think she expected us to stay there that long.
It's really interesting. Like I've seen reviews of this since we very kindly were given a copy at Aircon. Mm. And some people have criticized the game because they feel that the numbering system isn't always in the right order. So for example, a 10 might be slightly easier than a 9, but to be honest, that's not why I play this sort of game.
No.
One of the joys of a trivia game is not to kind of revert back to my GCSEs, but actually to actually learn something as well through that process. And I quite like that fact that there's always that element of push your luck. So for example, I picked 2 for Big Ben, thinking, okay, that's... that's going to be a relatively moderately complex question, but actually a two, you know, what would I would probably have expected to be number one, where is it, actually was question two. So I don't know what number one would have been. So I quite like that fact that you can't game this game.
Spell Ben.
No. Yeah, well, I think the first question was something like, is Big Ben the name of the biggest restaurant in the UK? Yeah, I mean, for me, it just, it does two things. Firstly, it solves, I think it really tackles the trivia question, the trivia problem of making people feel like they're silly or stupid, but still providing a trivia experience. So not swerving it all together like Wits and Wagers or like Boulder Dash or something like Snakes, the big potato trivia-based game that it released a few years ago. I think it really solves that. And also I think it really, it has, that structure does another two things, a sub two things. First of all, it really plays into my hubris and to idiots like me who really push their luck and go, right, I'm just going to get 10 all the time. 10, 10, 10, 10, yeah. 10, yes. But it also provides a really great catch-up mechanic.
Yeah.
That if, like, you are just 5 points away from the win and someone's going to go for it, it really gives you a right, I'm just going to go for six then. I'm just going to go for six. And if there's a topic that comes up and you feel really confident, you can really get ahead of steam. And there are other things in the game which are other great catch-up mechanics. So some of the spaces have little tickets on them, and they'll be and they're purposely made and designed to be ways of being able to catch up. So it'll ask you a question like, name as many yellow-coloured animated characters that aren't The Simpsons.
That's great.
And so you could name like 10 or 15 or whatever and catch up through that way. So it really does take a lot of time, and there's a lot of effort gone into this game to provide a genuine trivial experience that isn't trivial.
Well, that was one of the first games we played and was demoed and played when we arrived, Sam. I picked up probably the last game that was demoed to us and which we played a full game of. I came and found you sat with a company called Word of Mouth Games. Now, I think this was the first time they'd been to Aircon. They're based in Oxford and they tended to kind of tour like the South in terms of conventions and things. And in the same way that CDSK in some respects is kind of harkens back to those trivia games of old, and I know it's done gangbusters in France, there was something about Flip, Switch and Roll from Word of Mouth Games that really spoke to something quite classic for me. And it's a dice altering card game. It's not going to set the world on fire. I don't think it wants to do that either, but it's a very tight and fun 20-minute game in which you are playing quick, quiet, and a bit mean, I would say.
Yeah.
So there's a central pile in the center of the table, and the game continues until you've exhausted that pile, and it's made up of a part of numbers between 2 to 18, and you get a number at the beginning from the pile. And the way you get rid of that number, bank it and score it, is by ensuring that the three dice, which are six-sided in the center of the table, match the number that you have on your card. And you do this by playing what are called switch cards,
okay,
which allow you, when you play that card, to change the result of one or several of the other dice, or you can play a card to be mean to other players. So, for example, the three dice are rolled in the center of the table. I can play a card to flip two dice, or I can play as many cards as I want in my go, change two dice to the same number, or I can block a player's switch card they've just played, or force two players to swap number cards. And it's that lovely little elegant system of just working with these dice to try and find the right combination of cards to play, to ensure the dice are flipped and switched in a manner that just speak to the number you've got in front of them. And a few weeks ago, we spoke about a game that Sam got called Shifting Stones. And one of the things I like about that game And I love these sorts of games where you don't switch off just because it's not your go.
Mm.
So, for example, if by chance Sam flipped the dice or rolled the dice and it happened to be the sum total would be the number on my card, I can score it. So you're conscious of that as well, that you don't want to, on the way to your goal, end up helping somebody else score around the table. And that's it.
Yeah.
It's abstract. There are no frills. And I was just thinking, this is going to be a great game to play with my family. So it was a slam dunk purchase for me.
Yeah. And what's great, and it kind of typifies the convention experience, the guy who designed it was there,
yep.
Dexter.
Dexter Churches, yes.
And, and I was able to ask him, like, so how did this, you know, how did he come at this game? Like, where did the idea come from? And he was like, well, a few years ago, I came across the fact that opposite sides of the dice always add up to 7, and he never realized that before. So basically, that was like the starting point of the... Like, that was the genesis of the game.
Hmm.
The fact that he designed, you know, a prototype where you just roll dice and then you'd have a card which allowed you to flip certain dice to score a number. And so there is a little bit with this game of you just staring at 3 dice going, right, that's a 4, which means there's a 3 on the other side, and that's a 6, which means there's a 1 on the other side. So if I flip those 2 up and then add 2 to it, like, that will get me the number that I need. And it is like it is one of those games that you can see, and by talking to the person who designed it, like, I can really understand about, yeah, I can see, like, I really got that through playing it, how much that little traditional way that dice face are orientated inspired this whole game. It was lovely.
Does it not lose anything for... Because obviously I wasn't around for this bit because it was right at the very end. Does it not lose anything in the fact that, like, you know, you mentioned abstract, that tends not to be my favourite kind of stuff. Like, does it not lose anything by not having that? Or does it benefit from it?
I you know, at the moment, and you guys know this from me being aircon with you...
Yeah.
Like, at the moment, I've just got really... I don't know what it is. Most of the new games that I've been playing, and most of the games that I really want to play at the moment, are abstract card-based games, like Dutch Blitz, like Skyo, what else do we play? Sea Salt and Paper, and Trio, which is a game that I bought at the convention centre, and Flip Switch and Roll. And I think there was just something... I think there's something freeing sometimes about playing a game that doesn't really have a theme, or doesn't really lean into a theme, or have to present a narrative or do anything. Because I feel like within that space, within that vacuum, you kind of leave breath for not necessarily stories to evolve or narratives, but like it's more like myths and legends. So like when we played like Skyo, like, we just had this incredible game,
yeah,
which was just hilarious because the same things just kept on happening over and over again. Pete, you ended up, like, being able to, like, destroy rows quite often, and I was always getting lumped with, like, lots and lots of high cards. And just through how the game presented itself, like, it just started developing this, like, myth around it,
yeah,
that, like, for some reason all these things were just happening to the same players. And I just love that. And Dutch Blitz is the same, where you play it, and because there's no theme, there's no narrative, it just feels almost, this is going to sound a bit hyperbolic, but it almost makes those games feel kind of like mystical and
timeless.
Yeah. And I just love the fact that they're often quite portable, and, you know, there's minimal overhead in terms of rules and getting to the table, and they're just, you know, I just think they're just really great.
Yeah.
I think because I don't play like games, like as many games as you guys do, but kind of any time like people come around, if we're going to play some games and stuff, one of the games I always try and bring out, because it's got a bit of like a palate cleanser, kind of ease in, is something like Suro, which is very abstract.
Yeah.
It's just moving along a line on a map. There's nothing else to it, but it's wonderful and it's beautiful and it's simple and it's calm and it's there is an ease of access to something when it's abstract, I think, because you're not having to think. Yeah. You're not like, okay, so you are an assassin, okay? You are in Renaissance France and you have to kill blah, 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 blah. So none of that. It's just like, okay, you have to go past, you have to go along this line and stay on the board. And I think sometimes with when you have that, that abstract nature of it, depends on the type of game. As I say, I don't know how well it works in like a longer game, but in those short bursts, especially like something between courses in your gaming banquet, those kind of just dropping them in there, it's absolutely like a little palate cleanser that just kind of just engages your brain enough. And obviously certain things, something like Dutch Blitz obviously has that abstract stuff and is more kind of like frenetic than something like Sudo, which is very slow and calming and kind of gentle. But absolutely, I think that's where they kind of really sing those more abstract ideas.
But it's really interesting. I think there's also a sweet spot where there's a midpoint where I think of games like Splendor, where you could, if you wanted to, lean into the theme, oh, we are rival gem collectors, or you could choose not to and go, oh, those pictures are pretty, I'm just looking at numbers here and matching patterns and building sets. And I think one that is similar to that, in my view, that kind of sweet spot where you can lean into the theme or not lean into the theme, is Nunatak, which is a game we played, which is not, it's set to launch at the UK Board Game Expo, but we played a copy of it that had been lovingly and recently translated just to kind of for demo usage there, where we're kind of building essentially a Nunatak, but equally also we're competing with each other. I think some of the minutiae of that and its mechanics would have been not as palatable or easy to remember if it wasn't for there being something of a theme there.
Dan, do you know what a Nunatak is?
I was about to ask, going back to the whole thing of like, please don't make me say stupid, what is it? I have no idea what a Nunatak is.
On a scale of 1 to 10.
So I didn't know what a Nunatak was either. It's essentially like an ice pyramid.
Yeah. Is in a man-made ice pyramid or a naturally formed ice pyramid?
I think didn't the person who was demoing us said that they used to think that they were naturally made, but they've recently found out that they are actually they were man-made. Yeah. Nunatak translates as the ice mountain. So in this country, it will be known as the ice mountain. And I have to say that this was probably another one of my highlights from the convention center, and I do feel slightly guilty for it because we sort of said, oh yeah, we're going to play this game, we'll play this game, don't worry. And unfortunately they were really busy at the time, so Chris had set up a game of Merchants and Marauders,
yes,
and then suddenly there was a spot available to play the game, so I went off and said, oh, don't worry about me, let's play, I'll play. And then no one turned up to play with me. So I was like, Chris, Pete, I know you've set up this big,
ready to have a big open world.
You have to come and play with me.
Pirate adventure.
But can you come and play with me? It means a lot. And
I want to play a game.
But did you regret your decisions? Did you?
I didn't.
Absolutely not.
No.
No. It's so... The way that this game works is that you have a board in front of you, and then you also have these ice blocks, right? These like plastic ice blocks. And there's also a set of cards in a marketplace in front of you that you can pick from. And there are icons on the cards, and that allows you to... you're allowed to place your ice block on the corresponding icon on the board that's also on the cards, okay? These cards also have a sort of set collection mechanic to them. So, for example, if you get three of one kind of thing, then you get more of the points that figure out whether or not you're the winner at the end, and it all links together like that. In addition, once you have placed a block down, once you create a row of them or a square of them on this board, and there are little spaces where you have to put this block into each of these blocks into, you score based on lines and squares, these complete squares. And when you complete a square, you also take another piece of cardboard from a pile and you place that on top of the four ice cubes. And what you're doing is you're actually building up that next layer of the pyramid. Okay? Then, over the course of the game, you actually continue to build and build and build and build. And the pyramid will grow up to a point. There's a fun little hut that you put on the top of it at the end of it, which is quite nice, like almost like a little hat. The other big mechanic in there is that as you place an ice cube on top of a next layer, you also score points based on the number of cubes underneath that belong to you. Right? There's some more mechanics to it, but that basically is the game.
That's the nutshell, yeah.
And it started off, maybe it was just because it had been a long weekend and my head was still full of cold and flu medicine. It started off as it took a little moment for me to kind of wrap my head around it. But then as soon as I did, the game just flows like real fast. And it has that satisfaction of, you got that satisfaction of the strategy of putting together a set collection. Oh, I'm gonna get this particular card because if I get more of these, then that'll give me more of a bonus at the end. It's got the satisfaction of things like Connect Four, whereby you're trying to figure out these rows, these squares, and there's actually some strategic nuance that can go on there as well, whereby you can wait for your opponents to place their cubes in certain places and then you just put one right in the middle and, oh my goodness, you've scored all of these different things and gotten loads and loads of points. There's also that satisfaction that you get a little bit with things like Lego, whereby you're building a structure together, collectively building this structure, and you see this build up and up and up. And there's also that satisfaction that comes with some very nicely put together components and art and all of that good stuff. It pulls from all of these different areas, and each of the areas is quite lightweight by themselves, but in combination, it's one of these rare occasions whereby the more mechanics they've put in actually, that even if they're quite lightweight, they all combine into quite a satisfying whole.
I think what I found the most enjoyable thing about the game, and I think where it's going to actually create most of its appeal on the table and with people of different experiences of board games, in how I think it's one of those very... It's one of those games where you seldom come across that is not afraid of giving you points. Like, the amount of points that this game is always, constantly, every single turn, showering on players is at times, it's quite embarrassing. Like in a turn, it's like, well, 30 points for me, and it's 20 points for you, and here's a couple of points for you. Oh, more points, come on, bring on the point. And it's
points for everyone.
But it's like we play Goo Gong like the night before, and that is a game where it feels like you've got the world's driest flannel and you're just like squeezing it for all you can, and you can maybe like squeeze out 3 or 4 points after a couple of turns, and you kind of feel, oh thank God, like you're wiping the sweat from your brow that you just managed to get just that. And then there's Nunatak, there's like the Ice Mountain, where it's just no problem. Here's all the points. Like we got close to 200 points quite easily playing the game. And for me, I felt like I haven't felt that dopamine hit, that instant gratification of every single thing I did, every single time, got me something back. Mm-hmm. It was either points or it was the satisfaction of building something together as a team or getting another card from my set. And I think these days, you know, games like that are exceptionally quite rare and hard to come by. Like whilst I was at Aircon, I bought Dune Imperium Uprising, and that's a game where the winner is the first person who gets to 10 points. I won an attack by getting to 215, and it's just like this is your like the variances of play, and obviously I think they're both, you know, different experiences and they're going for different audiences, fair enough, but I think there has to be something said for how good that made you feel as a player.
Oh yeah,
just always, no matter what you do, you just get, it'll just get you some points, and it just feels brilliant.
It's the Peggle effect.
Yes, absolutely.
It's the Peggle effect. It's that thing of well done, well done, well done, well done, and like your mobile games have been doing it for years and years and years, and actually, it's a cheap thrill. It's an easy thrill to put into somebody. It's not that slow burning thrill of, I'm going to spend the next 5 hours playing this game and maybe I'll get 4 points out of it, right? But that's okay, because not every meal needs to be a Michelin star. Sometimes what you want is a happy meal.
But a question I want to ask is that, you were saying this, Sam, actually, when we were in the car journey coming back. I don't think we had a single bad play experience at Aircon.
No.
And I was wondering if that is just by chance, whether it was just we, after over a decade of playing games, we have a good intuition and being able to work out which ones are going to land with us or not, or whether it's just the novelty of playing a game at a convention. And you said, Pete, a Michelin star style meal. I don't think I could eat a Michelin star meal every day.
Mm-hmm.
Like having it once... No. There's a treat, there's an enjoyment, there's a novelty factor. It's a once-in-a-lifetime experience. It's incredible. Now, it makes me wonder if there are games that we played at Aircon that were, in that moment, they were perfect. It was a perfect storm. The planets aligned. There was a lull in the Aircon. Or whether actually these games actually have gears. And how do you tell that difference?
That actually kind of plays into something that kind of I was thinking about, because I've been to some kind of conventions, but not obviously as many as you guys. And I've kind of, when I kind of play games, I like to, it's sat in the around the living room on the sofas. It's a very kind of comfortable experience. And anytime I've played games at a convention, it's for me, it's kind of, I've never felt as comfortable. So it's always kind of been like, okay, the game is finished. Okay, pack it away. Let's go. Let's move on. I don't want to, whereas I'm at home, I'm more relaxed. Like, yeah, let's have another game. So I'm kind of in the same boat of kind of thinking like, is it a different experience in terms of the game itself? Kind of when you're in that environment, kind of for me it was, but my experience is very limited in that. So is that something you kind of get used to?
The one thing that the space has available to it is it can be very energizing.
Yeah.
Like it says something like when you're walking through a hall and you just see pit table on table on table on table, people setting up to play Twilight Imperium, someone sitting down to play Beer and Bread, just two of them, another table having raucous fun playing Just One, another table, Us Idiots there playing Dutch Blitz. Like that is really energizing and you kind of... It's kind of like walking past a buffet and oh, that looks good. Oh, yeah, maybe we'll try that a little bit later. You kind of start to get the feeling.
Go on, you're on holiday.
Yeah, treat yourself.
I also think that there's a tendency at conventions, certainly from my perspective, like I don't want to play games I've played before. Like I want to play new stuff. I'm there to see the new thing. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that it needs to be a game that's hot off the presses. It could be a game like Dutch Blitz that I've never played before. That's actually coming up on 120 years old or whatever it is, right? Like, I'm happy to do that, but I want to play something that's brand new because I go to conventions to actually find new stuff. And I think that that's one of the things that I think conventions are really good for, is to find... It's very difficult to... The most difficult thing to do with hobbies of any kind is to surface the good stuff. Like, that's why traditional magazines exist. That's why websites, I mean, it's why we exist, right? Like, we want to go and find that stuff. We want to go and talk about it, right? And we want to make recommendations. It's why you've got a group of friends that play games with you, or if you've got a particular hobby, like let's say you paint miniatures, for example, you will paint more miniatures if you have friends around you who say, do you want to paint some miniatures with me? And finding new stuff, conventions are really good for that, finding new stuff and trying new stuff. Whereas being at home, I think, is much more about, like, what do I already have? What do I enjoy playing?
So what was the new thing that you discovered?
Well, look,
this time,
I always go to these places looking for RPGs, war games, and all that sort of stuff. Because I love board games, I love playing them, but I very rarely buy a board game because they're not as my cup of tea. Love playing them, not a huge fan of owning too many of them. So, a couple of different things, really easy. Some of the straight-ups, easy stuff to talk about is, I got a Scrooge McDuck promo card for Lorcana because I sat down and played a game of Lorcana. I already owned it. I already know how to play it. I already have the deck that it comes from that card comes from. But I wanted the promo card because I'm some kind of sucker. And I was so thrilled because I love Scrooge McDuck. He's my favorite Disney character, probably. And I got to play that. So that was lovely.
He even slipped it into his lanyard, Dan.
Yeah.
So everyone could see. It was on proud display.
I had my promo card. So that was lovely. Finding a bunch of indie RPG stuff was really, really good. My favorite thing, which with that indie RPG stuff, you know, I'm going to read them and play them, and I'll probably talk about some of them in the coming months and potentially years, because I bought a couple of bits and pieces, which, by the way, we have photos up on our Instagram of. You can go and see all of the cool stuff that we got. But my favorite part of the weekend was getting to play an RPG with you folks. So we were booked in for a session of an RPG called Monster of the Week. And we were running, we were part of a session that was running that was called The Cows of Milford. And so Monster of the Week is a PBTA game powered by the apocalypse. And what that means is basically there's a family of games called Powered by the Apocalypse. It's kind of like an approach to how to play role-playing games and storytelling games. And they tend to be based around... they tend to be based around like archetypes and playbooks. So you'll have access to certain features of characters because you happen to be that kind of character. So if that sounds similar, if Dan, you're sitting there probably thinking, hold on, so that sounds kind of familiar, that's Blades in the Dark. Blades in the Dark is an offshoot of Powered by the Apocalypse. Okay, so Monster of the Week is, as it might suggest, it's inspired by TV series like X-Files, Supernatural, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, yeah. Those kinds of serialized TV shows whereby there would be a Monster of the Week. And it also has that kind of level of tone and feel as its default. So it can go as dark as you want, you know, going into some pretty hardcore stuff in The X-Files, for example. You know, that's some pretty sterling stuff there, but it can also go quite light, like some of the campier episodes of Buffy, right? And everything in between. So I've never played it before, so trying new things. And Sam, Chris, you hadn't played it before, had you?
No, but I fell in love with it very quickly.
Oh,
I'm a little familiar only for the fact of I think they did one of the series of the Adventure Zone podcast.
Did they?
Use the Monster of the Week campaign.
Yes.
Use the Monster of the Week kind of structure for one of their campaigns.
Okay, cool. So basically we turned up and the person running it was a person called Saul. Shout out to Saul. Saul did an amazing job of being the GM. And basically, it was a story about these cows, and they were in this place called Milford, and Milford was kind of like a slightly sleepy country town, you know, like big enough to be on the map, but small enough that, you know, they get, you know, the way that Saul described it is small enough that they get excited by the fact that an Aldi has just opened in there, near them, right? Like that kind of like, that kind of level of British countryside excitement. And we were a group of ragtag monster slayers, ultimately, and we were investigating into what happened, and was there any validation to these claims that this cow farmer, who'd had a cow go missing, basically claimed that aliens had abducted this one of their cows.
So is this the first time, like, Pete, I think you've done kind of RPGs in this kind of environment before.
Sam and I both did Traveller last year at Aircon. And it was great.
Yeah,
it was really weird. And this was really great as well. It was a really brilliant session run by Saul. Like, I was really, really impressed. And mechanically, the game is really easy to understand. So the difficult thing about RPGs quite often is that they do sometimes have quite a high barrier to entry in terms of like learning the rules, right? And it was taught to us within 5-10 minutes. Everything is really, really super straightforward. You essentially have a target number that you need to be able to beat. You roll 2 dice. There's a modifier that goes on top of that. So you might be +1 in toughness, and therefore you can add 1 to that score. And you need to hit a certain threshold of success. And like other games in the Powered by the Apocalypse oeuvre, you don't just fail at things, you fail forward. So you will succeed at a cost, like in Blades in the Dark, for example. So you'll get what it is that you want, but you might take some sort of complication. So combat's a really good example of this, whereby, yes, you've got a shotgun, yes, you've just blasted something, but they might take a swipe at you as you let loose, right? So that's the complication. There are a couple of important rules to remember in Monster of the Week. The first is that you actually take experience whenever you fail at doing something. So if you roll low, you actually get experience and you mark that on, and then you'll improve over time. One of the other really important things about Monster of the Week is that it follows that TV show format of you can't beat the monster until you know how to kill it. You're resolving the mystery, and that is the point in which you are able to vanquish it.
It's really, really lovely, because it doesn't matter how heavy your weapon is, you've still got to be deductive.
Yep.
So, for example, we had some players around the table who hadn't come to this RPG with any interest in kind of violence or bloodshed. For them, what interested them was the social dimension.
Yep.
Talking to Terry the farmer, for example, puzzling out what happened here, where this creature went, trying to understand its behavior and its motivation, rather than just, oh my word, there's something weird there, let's kill it.
Yep. And so the game itself is written by a creator called Michael Sands. It's published by Evil Hat Productions, who you might recognize that name from games like Fate, which is probably their biggest, one of the biggest ones that they put out. And I was so impressed with this after, you know, 3 or 4 hours of play. I was so, so impressed with how that session went, how much fun I'd had. I went and bought a copy. Like, I went and bought a copy on the show floor. I'm a huge fan of sessions that can be completed satisfactorily in one shot. Like, I think that is a really exciting way of playing RPGs. Like, I like campaigns, long campaigns, and there's something really cool about them. But I'm also a big fan of stories that have strong, you know, starts, middles, ends, and you're done with them in 2 or 3 hours. And Monster of the Week basically seems to be built for that. Yes, you can campaign in it, but basically, a huge part of the fun is running these characters as if you stole them and putting them through perilous situations to uncover the mystery of that week. I was absolutely blown away. Yeah, it was wonderful. And getting it to do it with my pals was just yeah, brilliant.
Just a quick shout out to some of the other people that we spoke to at AirCon, because there was so many, and I tried to make a note of everyone mm-hmm. who I spoke to, and they were all really nice. So I apologize if I miss anyone who's listening to this, but we bumped into Andrew at Yay Games again. Legendary Ominos creator.
Oh, hero.
He had a new game out that Chris swiftly yeah. bought up as well, a nice little sheep game, which is brilliant. Beyond Cataclysm, which was an RPG seller and outfit, which I'm definitely going to keep an eye on in future.
Loved their store.
Yeah, I was able to buy a copy of Eat the Reich, which is a Grant Howitt
book. Oh, so excited about this.
Which I'm going to run as a one-shot for us guys when we finished Blades in the Dark, which sounds great. There was like Rogue Artist Creations, SC Games. Me and Pete played one of their games. Sea Light Studios as well. I think you got a book from Sea Light Studios. So yeah, so, you know, absolutely fantastic and marvellous weekend it was.
If there was one course you'd like to learn in your hotel room, if there's a course that you could actually do in 10 minutes before you go down and meet your friend in the foyer of the hotel room,
yeah,
what would work? I mean a proper course, not nothing half-baked, one that has a certificate and everything.
One that has a certificate. I'm thinking a course on how to make the most nutritious hotel room-based meal. I'm thinking spaghetti in the kettle. I'm thinking tomato sauce in the kettle.
Everything in the kettle.
I'm thinking boiling sausages in the kettle. There you go. You got a bolognese.
Sam, that's not how cooking works.
Some sort of crash course on how to use a very small iron to get wrinkles out of a shirt.
With a certificate. Pete, do you remember when you went for a phase of just really just... It didn't matter for you unless you got a certificate.
You say phase.
Okay.
I mean, it's still going.
Yeah, you forget that Pete wants to go on holiday so he can get his scuba diving certificate.
Oh, you're so lucky you're going to Australia. What made you decide to go there? Well,
I was literally today thinking about applying for my personal functional license, which is the gambling industry has a thing whereby you pay 185 quid and then they certify you to be a croupier.
Pete, I've seen the way you shuffle.
Yeah.
Dealing the cards into lots of little piles. That's what I do because I can't shuffle.
That just strikes me that Pete has run out of obscure hobbies and has just resorted to kind of like flicking open a random book and pointing at something and saying, yes, I'll do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But were you not tempted to do what I did in Travelodge, which was learn how to do CPR and how to use a defibrillator?
When's that ever going to come into use?
True.
Yeah, what use is that?
Yeah.
So there I was in bed, awoken by Chris.
Pushing down on your chest. singing the Bee Gees.
No, but he was. He was there with his camera. So how the app works is like it takes you I don't want to think about what kind of big data the British Heart Foundation are getting into.
Yeah, they're the real baddies in this story, aren't they?
So they get access. So the website gives them access to your front facing camera. So Chris was there in the hotel room, broadcasting to everyone within the British Heart Foundation. I'm sure they were like, "Come on, lads, we've got another one. Look at that idiot in bed." And there he was, pressing up on down on the pillow. And I thought, okay. And then suddenly the BG start, and he's just like having a proper whale of a time.
Yep, there's like a little speedometer in the bottom left-hand corner telling me if I was pressing too fast or too slow. And Then then I had to do a little interactive thing on my phone to work out where to put the defib paddles and how to turn it on and stuff. And then it gave me a quiz at the end, which I passed with flying colours. And then I got a little PDF certificate.
So was a sleeping Sam in the background of your CPR test?
I was awake because you can't sleep through... Chris going on a pillow in the middle of the room.
Did Pete have his own room then? Pete wouldn't share.
Oh, of course he did.
Of course I did. I'm a prince.
Is there a penthouse suite in the Travelodge?
So if you have any ideas of courses that we could do, then do let us know. Do get in touch.
Yeah. Or if you went to Aircon, listener, and you played something that we've not spoken about and maybe we missed it in the whirly gig that was Aircon, do let us know.
And you can do that on stayinginpod@gmail.com.
Yeah. And you can also do that at stayinginpod on Instagram, where you can see all of the little reels that I made from each day of the convention, which is also, and this is the best bit about Aircon, is that some of those photos are us not at Aircon and just enjoying wonderful things in and around Harrogate, like the Timothy Taylor pub, Nutrition Joe's.
Tilly's,
Tilly Peppers, and Domo as well. So check them out on Instagram. Thanks very much for Hachette for loading me up with a copy of CDSK before we left. It genuinely has been the highlight with my friends and my family. And I've also taken it into work and played it with some people at work as well. I think it is a sterling example of what a trivia game should be. I think expect some more sort of Aircon mentions over the next few weeks on the podcast. We'll try not to make it too saccharine, but we did come away with quite a bit of stuff. So some of which you can see on our Instagram page as well. I think we will be talking about Eat the Right in future. And I think I will be talking ad nauseum, possibly, about June Imperium Uprising as well in a few weeks' time. Right.
Okay.
The one thing that wasn't at Aircon was a beach. But life's a beach. And we'll see you on it.
That was very Trevor McDonald in your delivery, Sam, at the end there.
Yeah, it was kind of like a bit more obscure. There wasn't a beach, so we'll see you on it. The beach thing.
And I just expected to just see Sam just straightening his papers and he just goes into darkness as we hear da 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 da